Finally tonight, ending extreme poverty around the world by 2030. That's the ambitious goal announced by World Bank President Jim Yong Kim as his organization and the International Monetary Fund begin their annual spring meetings with delegates from around the globe. The World Bank has come under strong criticism at various times since its founding in 1944, including, as it happens, by Kim himself. An American born in South Korea, Kim is a doctor, a leading global health advocate, and winner of a so-called MacArthur Genius Grant. In the late 1980s, he demonstrated against World Bank policies, even calling for its end. Last year, picked by President Obama, he became the bank's chief, after serving as president of Dartmouth College since 2009. I talked with Dr. Kim at World Bank headquarters in Washington this morning and began by asking what's new in his goal of attacking poverty.
We feel that the fact that there are still 1.2 billion people living in absolute poverty, which is less than $1.25 a day, is a stain on our collective conscience.
A stain.
And, you know, over the past 25 years, we've made a lot of progress. We've gone from 43% of the people living in absolute poverty to 21% today. But most of that was because China grew so rapidly. They lifted 600 million people out of poverty. It's never been done before in human history. But now the tough work remains. What we're seeing is a 1% a year drop in global poverty. But what's going to happen is that curve is going to flatten out, and flatten out pretty dramatically. And what we're saying is we now need to bend that arc downwards and really end poverty. And it's going to take a lot of effort to reach this target.
What kind of effort? I mean, give me a concrete example in a specific place even of what you would now do differently.
So what would you do in India differently if you're committed to ending poverty? Well, India, I visited a state called Uttar Pradesh, and this is a state in India that has over 200 million people. 8% of the people living in absolute poverty in the world live in Uttar Pradesh. And so in our plan for India, we're going to focus much more of our effort in those poorest states where the poor people live.
Is there an implied or even explicit critique of practices of the World Bank and other institutions of the past? I mean, you yourself were once one of those who demonstrated against or protested against the World Bank, right?
Absolutely.
Now, here you are. Hey.
Well, and I think it's an indication of how much things have changed. Back then, I was part of a movement called 50 Years is Enough, where we thought, you know, in the 50th anniversary, you should just shut down the World Bank.
Who needs it anymore?
But things have changed. 15 years ago, we were not at the forefront of tackling climate change. We were not at the forefront of insisting on gender equality in development programs. We are there now. It's a different organization, and we are united around this goal of ending poverty.
Could you have ever imagined yourself 15 years ago heading this organization?
Certainly not 15 years ago.
One of the critiques I've seen from some in the development country after you announced this the plan is that you're still focusing on growth as a way to bring everybody up, and not enough on the inequalities that exist within many societies, including many of the more developed societies.
Well, you know, the second part of the target, which is boosting shared prosperity, this is actually completely new for the World Bank Group. What we're saying is every year we're going to let countries know the extent to which the bottom 40% of income earners are participating in economic growth. In other words, we're going to measure inequality. We're going to measure the extent to which growth is inclusive. That's new, and that's very powerful.
You're going to tell how much they're behind, the bottom is behind the top.
How much, and then what?
What do you want them to do?
Well, we're going to be very specific about it, and we've been specific about it for years. We believe that the evidence shows us, and certainly the Arab Spring countries have shown us this, that if you have GDP growth without inclusion, you're building instability into your societies. And we feel that the evidence is overwhelming that putting women at the center of the development process, for example, is smart economics. That's what you should be doing. So it's not, you know, we're going to measure growth. We're going to measure participation in growth. We're going to measure poverty. But the things that you need to do to get there are varied. And what we know is that if you don't invest in health, education, social protection, you're not really being very visionary about what it's going to take to grow your economy in the future. That message is very strong, and I think people are hearing it from us.
Does this require new money? Because you're making this call at a time of slow growth in much of the world, negative growth in Europe, for example. What do you need from other countries, and how would you get it at a time like this?
Well, you know, if you look at the needs in the world, official development assistance, which is the money that the donor countries give, is about $125 billion a year. But let's look at just one country, India. I was just back from India. They have a $1 trillion infrastructure deficit over the next 5 years. So there's no way that official development assistance is going to be enough to tackle this problem. So this is one of the great strengths of the World Bank Group. We not only work in the public sector with development assistance, but we work in the private sector. We make direct investments, we make loans. It's going to take a major effort of bringing public and private together if we're to have any chance of meeting these targets.
Are you afraid that the world might fall backwards? I mean, there's been a lot of strides in the last couple of decades through China and other countries with poverty. We've had a number of years of very slow growth. Are you afraid now that we might be moving backwards?
We remain cautiously optimistic about what could happen in the future. We know that the developed economies have to grow in order for us to be able to meet our targets in the developing economies. But the growth in the developing economies has been one of the good news stories over the last 5 years. More than 50% of the growth globally has come from the developing economies, and this year they're going to grow at 5.5%. Part of it is because many of those countries have made tough decisions over the past 15, 20 years around fiscal consolidation, around investing in health and education, so they could lay the foundations for future growth.
Well, you know, one of the questions as you gather here is whether the World Bank is even relevant anymore, right? You've had a number of countries that have grown and made great strides. There are other areas of it where they can seek investment now than the bank. What's the case for the continued relevance of the bank, the World Bank?
You know, the BRICS countries, being Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the most high profile, if you will, middle income countries. You know, the experience that I've had in going to each of those countries is that they don't want less of the World Bank, they want more of the World Bank. And it's not so much that they need our money, but what they need is our expertise, and it's our very specific ability to work in the public sector, in the private sector, and we also provide political guarantees. So if you make an investment in a country and company is nationalized, we actually provide insurance, which is helping people to feel comfortable making the kinds of investments in developing countries that are needed. We've had 66 years of experience. We've gone through so many different conflicts in order to get to a place where the 188 member countries agree on where we should go and agree about the fundamental relevance of the World Bank Group. There will always be a need for our knowledge. There will always be a need for our ability to work across public and private sectors. There will always be a need for us as a neutral agent in a very contentious environment.
Let me just ask you finally about you personally, because World Bank presidents to this point have traditionally been from political backgrounds, from economic backgrounds, financial backgrounds. You're a doctor. You've spent your life in public health. What do you bring to this that's different?
Well, you know, for almost all of my adult life, I've been working in the area of development. I've worked in Haiti. I've worked in the slums of Lima, Peru. I've worked in the former Soviet Union countries. I've worked in Tomsk in Siberia. So I have been doing development my entire life. And the World Bank is a development bank. Our focus is on trying to help lift people out of poverty and to boost prosperity, a prosperity that's shared. And that's essentially what I've been doing all my life as an anthropologist and a physician. So I have been trying to fight poverty my whole life. And what I found is that inside the World Bank, we are just full of passion. The people in the World Bank want to end poverty. That's why they came to work at the World Bank. And because we share such fundamental values, we hope that we can be ever more effective in the years ahead.
All right, World Bank President Dr. Kim, thanks for talking.
Thanks, sir.
Dr. Kim has also promised a strong new effort to combat climate change, especially in the developing world. You can find that part of our conversation online. And again, the